From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. You've heard of pie-eating contests, of course, but did you know that pie, spelled P-I, is also the object of competition? Ahead on Only a Game, we'll hear from the ultra-competitive elite reciters of pie, the number which represents the relationship of a circle's diameter to its circumference. Also, some very fast tortoises tear up the tracks of Indianapolis, an appreciation of the late writer W.C. Hines, a talk with a Phillies catcher who was once a really, really old Major League rookie, and table hockey for bookbinders, jewelry repair persons, piano tuners, and violin makers. Stay tuned for the best of Only a Game, Summer 2008 edition. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Each March 14th, math enthusiasts celebrate Pi Day, named for the irrational number which represents the ratio of a circle's diameter to its circumference. On March 14th of 2008, computative whiz kids and spectators gathered at Harvard University to see who could recite Pi to the furthest digit. Only a Game's Rachel Paste was there, and she has our report.
Pi, 3.14, and so on and so on. The infinite. Transcendental number.
Come to the front if you would like to recite as much of pi as you can. Volunteers.
Today, five gentlemen are competing to see who can recite pi out the farthest, which could theoretically take forever if not for the limitations of the human brain. Computers have calculated pi out over 1 trillion places past the decimal. But humans reciting the number out hundreds, even thousands of places? This is going to be a long day. Today's competitors won't come close to a trillion, but they sure will have fun trying. Harvard University graduate student Ryan Reich attends this event every year.
It's entertaining. I mean, some people think memorizing pi is stupid, but I don't know. People can do what they want with their own brains, and you don't have to just limit yourselves to some sort of high-minded intellectual pursuit. If you like, feel like rattling off 1,000 digits of pi, like I expect to hear from somebody, then that's fun to watch.
It's a few minutes past 3, and the Harvard Math Lounge is beginning to fill up. Students, mostly male, are sitting on the sofas lining the somber light gray walls, but they rarely speak to each other, except to comment on each other's t-shirts. Some are solid colors, and many are tie-dyed. Almost all sport complicated algorithms, or at the very least the pi symbol. John, from Lancaster, Mass., wears a basic blue t-shirt. He's not here for the fashion.
Looks like fun. We can't wait to see how everybody does. I'm not that great with math, so I'm going to just bask in the greatness of all these people memorizing so many numbers and having fun with it.
John's not the only spectator who can't recite the digits of pi. There's also Scott Commodores.
My complete memorization of pi stops at 159.
Not bad, actually. And for those who want to learn pi, but can't stand the idea of rote memorization, Harvard math professor Noam Elkies has the answer, a song.
The steganographic etude or mnemonic etude, unfortunately transcendental etude is taken already.
Professor Elkies, through his music, has memorized 240 digits of pi, far more than one of today's entrants, Josh Gottlieb, a Harvard PhD candidate in economics. He says he's not a pi savant, just a normal guy with something to prove.
In high school, my calculus teacher, Mr. Schlanger, rumor had it that he knew 100 digits, and so I had to challenge him. So I learned enough to go head-to-head with him on the last day of class. 3.14159265358979323846264.
Showing up Mr. Schlanger takes only a few minutes, and after reciting 102 places, Josh takes a seat with the rest of the growing audience. Then Cameron Freer takes center stage.
1101 1010 1010 0010 0010.
Tie-dye math t-shirt. Check. Recite pi in binary. Check. Freer is a Harvard math PhD candidate, but why the choice of binary?
Well, a few years ago, there were a few entrants in the hexadecimal contest as well as base 10, but not
in binary. And so people were just computing it on the fly from hex. But I thought that maybe an entry in base 2, just looking at it directly, might be easier. And so I just found some small initial segment that had reasonable patterns. It seemed to have an unreasonable number of patterns. And so learned the 50 digits over lunch.
50 digits over lunch. Easy as, well, pi. Next up, Sean Peasley of Kentucky. He speaks much more quickly than the previous two contestants and is so nervous he actually shakes throughout the recitation.
7452841102701.
Sean is the leader at this point with 481. Up next is Boston College junior James Niles Joyle. He participated last year, but his nerves got the better of him. He played piano to calm himself this time around, and, after weeks of study, knows what he has to do.
To recite 3,141 digits of pi to prove my legitimacy and apparent greatness as a pi memorist of the world.
And then he shows what he's made of.
3.14159265358979323846262.
A few minutes into James' recitation, the crowd is becoming restless. No one is quite sure how long it takes to recite 3,000 numbers. We may be here forever.
938446. That's 1,000.
The room is silent. There's tension in the air. It's been 20 minutes. Only 2,000 digits to go. After a moment of hesitation, a student on crutches sits down. Following his lead, the 90 or so assembled here do the same as James commences his mathematical journey.
3003558767.
50 minutes, 10 seconds later, James Niles Joyle has the record.
201497442. I'm done.
Yes. James is clearly thrilled, but not everyone knows how to feel. Some are impressed, like student Jay Pothurst.
I didn't expect nearly the level of tension and excitement that I encountered.
But Aaron Silberstein of Harvard and Kartik Vekatram of MIT, both math PhD students, debate the validity of the contest.
Memorizing digits of pi is somehow a parlor trick. And if you want to study pi, then that's a fine thing. Pi is a very interesting number in and of itself. But being able to spout out a random, you know, base 10 digit is not a substitute for understanding of any phenomena that the number pi might be.
The actual acquisition of the digits of pi are pretty much a waste of time, but the skills you build up learning digits of pi are not necessarily useless.
Regardless of what these students think, there is one person in the crowd whose pride cannot be swayed.
I'm really happy for him that he did it. He felt like he wanted to do this, and he did it. I'm really proud of him. I really am.
That's my mom.
For Only a Game, I'm Rachel Paste in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Before the 2008 Indy 500 even began, Indianapolis had crowned a champion. Lynn St. James, an Aldabra tortoise, was declared winner of the 27th running of the Zoopolis 500 at the Indianapolis Zoo. Lynn was pitted against another Aldabra tortoise, AJ, to mark the move of the tortoises from their winter enclosure to more spacious summer digs. The zoo's Judy Gagan joined me to discuss the race, and I asked her about the contest, which, according to some reports, was the most controversial in years.
Well, the controversy really is wasn't that controversial. Here's what happened. AJ is much larger than Lynn, but he was in a mood this year, and he just motored down the raceway with Lynn following. And Tony Kanaan was our guest chief steward, and he had said that the winner was the one who ate the first bite of fruit when they got to the end. So AJ more or less got that first, although it was close. It was neck and neck the entire way. But instead of eating the food, he actually sort of walked through the food.
Oh.
So then Lynn came up a little bit behind him and ate first. So you are.
So really, if AJ had just been a little hungrier for the win, he might have taken it.
That's exactly right, Bill.
Oh, okay. Andretti Green Racing's Tony Kanaan, you've mentioned, made the controversial ruling. Indy drivers have participated in this event for years. How difficult is it to find a driver who's willing to spend a day at the zoo during what has to be a very busy week for these guys?
Well, it's not a whole day. It's a few hours, and it has not been tough at all. And I must say a special thank you to Sam Hornish Jr., who actually was our guest driver for the past, I think, 6 or 7 years, ever since he started as a rookie at the 500. So Sam was absolutely terrific to work with and is a wonderful guy, and as we know, is off in NASCAR these days. So this was our first year working with Tony Kanaan, and he's just absolutely wonderful, too. So it's a fun event. So I think they actually enjoy kind of doing something a little different, you know?
Well, let's get some of the details out front here. How far do the tortoises travel, and how long does it take a really fast racer to finish the course?
Well, it's not too far. It's in our Dean's Milk Jug Arena in our encounters area, and it's probably maybe 100 feet. I mean, it's not real long, and on a good day, we're talking about 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
10 minutes, yeah.
For 100 feet. I'm not sure I can work that out in miles per hour.
Well, it's not super fast, but for a tortoise, it's pretty darn good.
All right. This year, I understand, 4 smaller radiated tortoises also took part in the event, but you wouldn't have known it by watching the event.
No, that's true. We were a little surprised. These little radiated tortoises are tiny in comparison to the Aldabra tortoises, which are large. I mean, AJ's probably somewhere between 500 and 600 pounds, and Lynn about a quarter of that. These little guys are sort of the what you would think of as a normal tortoise. They're maybe, you know, 10, 12 pounds. And they were all lined up behind, and we thought they'd scooter around and give them a race. But no, they were just too small, and AJ and Lynn were just in a mood to race this year. That's always good. The weather was perfect. That helped.
Was there any food left for the little guys by the time the big tortoises got to the finish line?
Of course. They don't eat much. In fact, when they were loading them up to take them over to their exhibit, I kind of peeked my little head in, and one of the little radiated tortoises had found a big hunk of tomato, and he was gnawing away and dripping juice down his little tortoise head. It was very cute.
Well, I think that's fine, and I gather tortoises being tortoises, probably even though there was winning involved, there was no milk involved.
There was milk involved, of course.
Oh, excellent.
Our friends of the American Dairy Association, we had a wreath and the traditional cold glass of milk for the pit crew of the winning tortoise, Lynn St. James.
Everything you say suggests the possibility of another question. What the heck does a pit crew do in a tortoise race?
They keep them moving straight.
Oh.
That's very important. Lynn, for example, kind of blew a tire at one point and kind of scattered off to one side, and we had to get her back going in the right direction. So pit crews are very important in tortoise racing.
Judy Gagan is with the Indianapolis Zoo. Judy, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, you're very welcome.
My pal the tortoise, how fast does he go? And he goes like crazy. What about the cut of his jib? I think the finest cut you'll ever find. What does he file at the Hall of Records? A proclamation of tortoise intent.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour.
You hit it left, you hit it right.
There are a lot of bad golfers. Some of them are bad enough so that they rarely finish a hole in fewer than 7 shots, and lots of them lose golf balls. But in a recent company outing at the Newmacher Golf Club in Scotland, Mr. Alan Errington not only averaged 7 shots per hole, he lost 23 golf balls through the first 8 holes, which, come to think of it, means that Mr. Errington's report of his score was exceptionally creative. He didn't really average anywhere near 7, did he? In any case, from the 9th tee, he knocked the ball into the hole. More unlikely, the ace won him a car, and most unlikely, the car is a Volkswagen Golf.
The pros don't have these problems. They look so debonair. You never
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with Chris Coast, who cracked the Philadelphia Phillies roster as a 33-year-old rookie. But first, last fall, as Wendy Milson began to prepare her seventh-grade class at the Winthrop School in Bridgeport, Connecticut, for the math program that would absorb the students for the next couple of months, her first questions had to do with numbers, sort of.
Hey, ladies, how much is Peyton Manning?
9,000?
Oh, excuse me, 9 million, yes. Thank you.
Ms. Milson's all-female math class was established in connection with the Athena program, which was designed to test the proposition that girls would more efficiently learn math and science in a class of their own. These particular girls have been learning their calculations via a fantasy football program. A dozen teams of two girls, each with a budget of $40 million fantasy dollars, drafted players, then began using various mathematical operations to determine which collections of players were performing most effectively.
This is our first week, so they're going to be stumbling a little bit right now. And we calculate using fractions, decimals, and multiplying and adding the things that they hate the most. And they're calculating right now how many points their players scored this week.
The program Wendy Milson's students are using was developed by Dan Flockhart, a former math teacher who believes the academic curriculum should relate to something students already care about. He grafted various mathematical operations onto fantasy football, designing programs that require progressively more difficult calculations. Flockhart maintains that from third grade through high school, the principle is the same.
There's so much focus on testing and accountability right now in our school system. That's the primary goal. I think our first goal should be to get students to even come to school, and the second goal should be to motivate or engage students. Adolescents are interested in pop culture, technology, which includes iPods, cell phones, and video games, TV, dating, hanging out with their friends, and sports. Everybody can relate to sports. So that's where these programs really come into play.
Play is the operative concept here, which, as far as Wendy Milson is concerned, is what distinguishes this way of teaching math from the way she was taught to do it.
It's a bonus that they learn the math a lot easier, not a lot more willing, as opposed to if I stood up there and taught this, not without the, you know, without the fantasy football, and I just went up there, this is how you add a fraction, let's multiply, and they're going to be like, oh my God. This way, the interest is piqued, they're more willing to accept it as the rules of the game. The competition is what, you know, kids this age love. They love to compete.
The competition here differs from that which characterizes the fantasy football leagues in which millions of adults compete. In the leagues that absorb the grown-ups, each player can only be drafted by one team. In Wendy Milson's class, the AJ Hotties, Puerto Rico's Most Wanted, Atlantalicious, and the Diamonds, spelled with a Z, could all draft Eli Manning. In fact, they all did, partly because he shared at least some of Peyton Manning's genetic makeup, but mostly because he was less expensive than his celebrated brother. In this league, once the rosters are in place, teachers might say, okay, multiply the number of times one of your players gains 10 or more yards by 1/8, and now convert the resulting number to a decimal. The possibilities are at least numerous, which is what Dan Flockhart had in mind.
Teachers are taking this program and just running with it. It's so flexible. In each program, there are over 100 scoring systems. So, for instance, in a basic scoring system that some teachers in third or fourth grade are using, a touchdown would be worth 6 points, as it normally is in real life. In fifth and sixth grade, teachers are using scoring systems with fractions or decimals, so a touchdown could be worth 1/4 or 0.25. In high school, some teachers are using scoring systems that deal with negative exponents, so a touchdown could be worth 2 to the negative third power.
But back to the Winthrop School, where by late December, Ms. Milson's students had determined the winners. I asked one of the co-owners of the team at the top, Rosaria, whether she'd learned more about football than she had about math.
Football.
You seem so sure of that. But this program is supposed to teach you about math.
Well, I learned more about math, but it's mostly about football. That's what I like about it. Learning how to do fractions better. Adding them, dividing them, multiplying them makes it easier. So that when I get to eighth grade, I know how to do fractions better.
One of Rosaria's strategies was redrafting each week the players who were doing well for her. Among them was Reggie Bush.
Well, because he's a good player. I think he's a really good running back, and he really looks good.
Among the students pursuing more unorthodox strategies was a crafty co-owner named Tavana, or at least she initially thought she was crafty.
Well, we got $40 million, I think, to spend on the players, and I only spent $1 million.
What, did you think that meant you get to keep the rest?
I thought so, like, we get to go shopping with the rest of the money. I thought we get to do that. But I only spent $1 million, and all the players, some of them were good, like Marty Booker and Damon Heward. But the rest of them, I'll be lucky if I get 2 touchdowns in 1 week. That sucked.
Tavana's team finished 5th, but she says she learned the math, too, and her teacher says the program has worked for all the girls in the class.
I love it. I mean, they're not afraid of fractions. They're not afraid of converting decimals. I even threw in an algebraic linear equation up here, and they were doing these equations like they were nothing. They're like, it's so much easier, and I was, like, shocked.
Which sounds to me like, in a way, what you've done is tricked them into thinking that this is just fun.
Yes.
And then, coincidentally, they managed to learn a lot of math skills.
Actually, that is exactly what happened. It's amazing. And then they asked to do more. They want to do basketball now. And I'm like, so you want to do more math? They're like, yes.
Wendy Milson's next project will be implementing a math program attached to fantasy basketball. She might be forgiven for hoping her students won't discover in the NBA a player they regard as highly as they do the aforementioned Reggie Bush.
Don't mention it to them. They just love that man. They were supposed to be printing graphs at one point. Next thing you know, they're going, look, miss, look. And I'm saying, what are you doing? They're printing out pictures of Reggie Bush. I'm going, wait a minute, that's not a requirement. We do not. I didn't ask you to do that, but he gotta admit, he is a very good-looking man. So I don't blame the girls. At least they have good taste.
According to Dan Flockhart, more than 100,000 students in schools across the country are currently learning math skills through fantasy sports programs. Maybe they're all having as much fun as Ms. Milson's students in Bridgeport.
We added all the totals.
You added all the numerators. There. How come you added all the numerators?
Because the denominator was supposed to stay the same.
Very good. Very good. Oh, good.
I told you earlier, you thought you were out wrong.
No, you're right. No. Very good.
You just got it from me.
Or maybe not.
Okay, so how did you get 78, 48?
Because we added these points.
Okay.
Now, 11 times 10 is the same as 10 times 11. 10 times 11, it's 110, no matter what you do. And 121 is the answer to 11 times 11. And 11 times 12 is 132.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org.
Good 11. Yes, 11 will always be a friend of mine.
Through the first 11 years of his career in professional baseball, Chris Coast played 8 different positions for 12 different teams. He played for minor league clubs in the Cleveland Indians system and in the systems of the Red Sox, the Brewers, and the Phillies. He played in Mexico, Venezuela, and Panama as well. But until he was 33 years old, he'd never played for a major league club. Therein lies the tale told in The 33-Year-Old Rookie, Chris Coast's first book. The author and catcher for the Phillies, the Major League Philadelphia Phillies, joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, you got it. Good talking to you.
12 years of minor league and independent league and Panamanian league baseball is a long time. What was the closest you ever came to giving up on making a major league roster?
Well, there was, it depends what my mood was on a particular day, but I think, I don't know if I was ever really close. I think the reason why I kept on going no matter what was because I always knew baseball was my path. I think if I had to pinpoint one particular time, it was after the 2006 spring training when it looked like I was going to make the team, and an hour before the deadline to finalize the rosters, they traded for David Alucci, sending me back to the minors. I had this incredible 2006 spring training looked like I was going to make the team, and I told myself, man, if I can't make it after that spring training, I'm never going to make it. So I was actually lucky that I didn't have a couple million dollars set aside, because maybe I would have walked away. I don't know.
Well, you write about one particular spring training with the Indians organization, during which you're hitting about 400 in the minor leagues. And the way you put it, quote, some of my teammates found it hard to look me in the eye. Why was that?
Well, they knew that I was the guy that was getting bypassed for other players. And especially in 2002, I was having this great season. And for some reason, the decision makers up above would choose somebody else. And my teammates kept telling me, man, that should be you up there. That should be you getting called up. Things like that, my teammates, is what kept me going as well.
Your manager with that minor league team in the Indians organization was Eric Wedge, who now, of course, is managing the Cleveland Indians. Are you embarrassed to have written, Eric wedged me into the lineup?
Yeah. You got to throw some puns in there every now and then. But no, I think he appreciated that. In fact, you know, when he found out I was writing a book, he made sure that his name was going to be in there at least once.
You went to Concordia College in Minnesota, but you write that you never really had a backup plan in case pro baseball didn't work out. If you had had an alternative plan, do you think you would have endured 12 years in the minors and in the winter leagues in various Latin American locations?
Probably not. I think if I would have gone back to do it all over again, I would have gone in a different direction in college, maybe went into education, become a teacher and a coach. But at the same time, it worked out pretty well. I didn't have a backup plan because, like I said earlier, I always knew baseball was my path to follow. And in those days when I was disappointed with my career, I just assumed that maybe if I don't make it as a player, maybe I was meant to make it as a manager. So I assumed that the longer I played, it would make me a better manager in the future. All the best managers in baseball are those guys that played a long time. They weren't great players, but they were able to stay in the game as long as possible and understand every guy's personal situation. I assume that was my destiny.
Based on what you've written here, it sounds as if you were talking to your wife on the phone. You had to put her on hold to take the call through which you learned that you had finally made it to the big leagues. You were going to join the Phillies. Tell me about the rest of that call with your wife.
Well, when I was on my drive to Philadelphia, I wasn't officially on the team. I was only going just in case the other catcher went on the disabled list, which I pretty much knew he was not. So when I got in my car and started driving and called her up, I was trying to keep her calm to make her realize that I'm probably not going to be activated. I'll probably get to Philadelphia and have to turn right back around again, which was fine. You know, I was on the radar, which was a positive at the time. And I'm on the phone with Ruben Amaro Jr. and my wife was on hold another line, and Ruben tells me, hey, you're going to the big leagues. You're on the team. We had a guy retire. You're officially a Philadelphia Philly. Well, I clicked back over to my wife, and the first thing I said is I got traded. And she says, to who? And I go, to the Phillies. We're going to the big leagues. And she just, I mean, it was absolute anarchy on the other end of the phone. It was screaming and yelling and crying all at the same time. And it wasn't until I heard the emotion in her voice and her screaming and crying. You know, we've been together since we were 16 and 17 years old, so she probably appreciated the path to get to the big leagues as much or more than I have.
And I understand that your daughter was especially delighted with the promotion.
My daughter was 7 years old at the time. She grew up in the minor league life. She grew up with, you know, the dream just as much as we have. So coincidentally, my wife's family and my family were throwing my wife and daughter a going away party because the next day they were on their way to meet me in AAA. The school was out for the year. And when my wife broke the news to everyone at the same time, my daughter eventually yelled out about 10 seconds later, hey, Mommy, that's what I wished for last week when I blew out the candles in my cake, was for Daddy to get to the big leagues. Well, when I heard that story is when it made me realize just how smart my 7-year-old daughter was, because we had groomed her for years. You know, for example, let's say she wanted a swing set or something that we didn't necessarily want to buy her. We'd always say, well, if Daddy gets the big leagues, we'll buy you that. So she knew that getting to the big leagues meant more money and a heck of a lot more toys. Let me tell you, she had a great Christmas that next year. That's for sure.
That doesn't surprise me a bit. I'm talking with Chris Coast, author of The 33-Year-Old Rookie, and you're listening to Only a Game. It would have been a grand story if after you'd made the Phillies roster in 2006, you'd caught a few games, banged out a couple of hits, and then retired. But, of course, it hasn't turned out that way. You played solidly for two seasons. You hit a home run in one of your first two games this spring. I wonder how many Major League general managers are saying to themselves right now, gee, we could have had that guy coast for peanuts 10 years ago.
It's possible. I would hope there's a few guys out there, but, you know, I just got to do my job, and when I get a shot to play, I'll try to do it well. I've always had that drive to be a somebody. You know, I've always, every level I've ever gotten to, I started out as a nobody, whether it was independent baseball or Double A, I was the last guy in the roster. When I got to Triple A, I was a fill-in, and when I got to the big leagues, same thing. So I've always had that drive to, you know, prove the decision makers wrong. I always had that drive to prove that I was a somebody because, like I said, every level I felt like a nobody, and it was always my goal not to be a superstar, but just to prove that I am indeed a somebody.
How are things going so far this season?
Well, I find myself as a backup catcher, which is a perfect fit for me because at the age of 35, if I'm an everyday catcher, you know, who knows how long I could do it. As a backup catcher, I could probably, you know, catching once or twice a week, I could probably do this 5, 6, maybe 7 more years. I keep myself in decent shape, and I've always had the most success when I'm playing 2, 3 times a week, 1, 2, 3 times a week. My body's healthy and strong, and obviously with the Philadelphia Phillies, an exciting team with the likes of Chase Utley, Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard, and the list goes on. It's a fun group of guys to be around. I just hope I can be a part of it for many more years to come.
On the Phillies website, your hobby is listed as writing. Hobbies. Isn't that where most major leaguers put hunting, fishing, or collecting vintage automobiles?
Well, I have a lot more hobbies, but I guess at the time when I filled that out, I was probably either just finished writing the book or in the process of writing the book. So that was, at the time, it probably made a heck of a lot of sense.
How do your teammates feel about having a writer in the clubhouse?
Well, they joke one of two things. Hey, is this a tell-all book? Which obviously it is not. And then secondly, their next question is, you know, when am I getting my copy? When am I going to get this book? And the next thing I say is, well, you're going to have to wait for it to come out on audio CD because I'm not quite sure how many guys in this room can read. So I got to wait for the audio.
Chris Coast is a catcher with the Philadelphia Phillies. He's also the author of The 33-Year-Old Rookie, published by Ballantine Books. He spoke to me from NPR's New York Bureau. Chris, thanks very much for joining me, and good luck this season and beyond.
You got it. Great talking to you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Brian Young Gun Krause recently won his 7th Cherry Pit Spitting Championship, but it wasn't easy, and though Krause lives in Diamonddale, Michigan, the implications of his victory are weirdly Greek. In order to win, Young Gun not only had to spit a pit 56 feet 7 and a half inches, he had to outspit his father, Rick Pellet Gun Krause of Tuba City, Arizona. The elder Krause, who was the defending champion, could only manage to spit a pit 56 feet 1 inch, good enough for second place. I wish he'd been left on the hillside for the wolves as an infant, as I instructed, cried the elder Krause. No, he didn't. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, bookbinders and jewelry makers get their day in the sports spotlight. But first, years ago I had the pleasure of meeting one of the finest writers of this or any other time, W.C. Hinds. But you don't have to take my word for it. On an afternoon in 2000, we talked in his home in Dorset, Vermont, and Bill recalled for me another reader who'd been especially fond of his novel set in boxing, The Professional.
Evan Thomas was the editor of the book. And the phone rang, and he said, Bill, we just got a cable from Hemingway. He quoted it to me, and so Betty said, well, who is that? And I said, well, that's my editor at the Harper's, and he's just read me a letter, a cable in which Hemingway says, quote, the professional is the only good book I've ever read about a fighter, and an excellent first novel in its own right, close quotes Hemingway. Well, she said, I think we should have a drink to that. We sat down in front of the fire, and she said, you know, I can remember when we had the little house, and you used to have to move a card table into the bedroom. You were working for the sun then, 5 days a week, sometimes six, and you'd come out and you'd look so depressed, and you'd go to the bookcase, and you'd find something of Hemingway's, and you'd sit down and you'd read it. And she said, you know, this must be the greatest day in your life. And I said, if you don't stop, I'm going to cry. And she said, a tear just dropped in my drink.
Bill Hines died on February 27th. He was 93 years old. After Hines' passing, I asked Jeff McGregor of Sports Illustrated, who had profiled Bill Hines for the magazine in 2001, if it would be an exaggeration to say W.C. Hines taught a lot of people, including a lot of writers, how good writing about sports could be.
No, I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. In fact, Bill's legacy is everywhere around us. Bill was one of the best, if not the best, sports writers ever. Others have risen to his level, but I think consistently over the arc of a career, there was nobody better than W.C. Hines.
He was the co-author of the novel MASH, upon which the movie and the TV series were based, and he collaborated with Vince Lombardi on Run to Daylight, which was enormously successful, of course. But I think he was especially proud of the work that he did during World War II.
Yes, it was overwhelming in its way emotionally for him, and one of the ways he dealt with that was by learning to underwrite. And this was one of the reasons that Hemingway was such a great hero of his. He so understood, he so appreciated the ability of Hemingway to deliver huge emotion with the careful crafting of words and pauses, that when it came time for him to begin writing about these terrible things he saw around him, that was sort of the only way he could do it. And the writer he became later, the famous sports writer, was very much born as he followed the Allies across Europe.
Beyond distinguishing himself as a superb writer, Bill was a supportive friend to many younger writers. Tell me what led you to characterize him as a godfather to us all.
He was that to me, certainly at a personal level. There was no part of the craft about which he would not talk to those who value the craft. When I went to meet him in 1999, I was beginning this profile, and discovered immediately that we both spoke the same language. It was very funny. This piece ran in 2000 in Sports Illustrated. It was a very long piece, and it was pretty well received, and a lot of people were very excited to have rediscovered W.C. Hines. And at some point, he sent a copy of the magazine back to me. And there was a note attached that said, I love this, but take a look at page, whatever it was, page 83. And I go to look at page 83. He's actually corrected one of my sentences. So here's this epic tribute to one of the great men in our field. And he felt no shame at all about saying, no, it's not like in this sentence, it's as. Don't you know anything? And that was Bill Hines. I mean, that was the look. You know him.
Well, there was the other side too, though, because I had the opportunity to send him some of my own stuff over the years when we were corresponding. And yes, he would make corrections, but he also would write in the margins, "This is very good."
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yeah.
His generosity, and I don't want this to tip over into elegy, but his generosity of spirit was one of the things that made him such a great writer. Mm-hmm. And he conducted himself in print the way he conducted himself in life.
When I first spoke with him in Vermont, Bill was 86 years old, and perhaps to humor me, he agreed to recite the beginning of one of his most celebrated magazine stories. It's a tribute to a boxer named Bummy Davis, who was infamous, I guess, for hitting guys below the belt, but who earned a certain celebrity by taking on three gunmen who were trying to rob a bar where Bummy was drinking. Let's listen to a little bit of just the beginning of that piece.
It's a funny thing about people. People will hate a guy all his life for what he is, But the minute he dies for it, they make him out a hero, and they go around saying that maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all, because he sure was willing to go the distance for whatever he believed in or whatever he was.
The title of that piece is Brownsville Bum. Jimmy Breslin called it the greatest sports story ever. It's among them, don't you think?
Oh, it's certainly in the top 10. I mean, it's just, it's the platonic ideal of what you want a story to be when you set out to write it. And for the rest of us, the state of being a writer is watching your work turn to ashes in your hands because you're not good enough to do what you picture in your head. And Bill Hines was this magician who pictured the thing in his head and then made it real in the world. These pieces arrived in the state in which he imagined them. And I cannot convey to anybody who doesn't do this for a living how rare a thing that is.
Jeff McGregor, the Sports Illustrated writer whose excellent profile of W.C. Hines ran in that magazine in 2000, joined me from his home in New York. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
In the years after we met, Bill Hines and I maintained a correspondence. He was exceptionally supportive of my work and generous with his suggestions, for which I am very grateful. He was a wonderful storyteller. He was also a thoughtful host. After one visit my wife and I made, he wrote me a postcard to say that if the air conditioning had been on too high, he was sorry. Toward the end, Bill's life was difficult. When that's the case, it's always tempting to wish that it had been otherwise. That's a notion that would have made Bill smile. When I first read The Professional, the novel that Ernest Hemingway had enjoyed so much, I was struck by the story's ending, which seemed cruel and unfair. When I met Bill, I asked him if he'd been tempted to write a more cheerful ending. No, he told me, because that's not the way it happens. W.C. Hines has said it's the work, in the end, that is the important thing. He has left behind work that will be treasured as long as people continue to read. We are constantly reminded that it's not just big colleges with even bigger football programs that get wrapped up in athletics. In December of 2007, Only a Game's Karen Given brought us the story of a very different kind of school and its yearly obsession with a very different kind of sport.
If you take a walk down the hallways of the North Bennett Street School in Boston's North End, you're likely to stumble across an instructor in piano technology pounding out sour notes, or maybe a future violin builder stringing up his first instrument. But round the corner to the bookbinding department during the fall semester, and you'll see and hear something else entirely. For the past 10 years, the country's oldest trade school has been developing its varsity table hockey program. Why? Well, ask bookbinding instructor and athletic director Mark Anderson.
I came from Washington, University of Washington, where the football team is a little overly important to the rest of the school. And I came here and thought that we really can't be a legitimate secondary school without an athletic program that overwhelms the academic mission of the school. And I just thought that table hockey was the perfect way to achieve that.
Anderson's joking, of course. In fact, the whole tournament seems to be one big, completely obsessive, all-consuming joke. At the end of it all, the table hockey players, which this year included fully half the student body, receive and honor a bunch of 30-somethings with artistic leanings, aren't likely to earn otherwise.
Oh, yeah, they each get a varsity letter and a crossed hockey stick pin. It's quite fun to walk around the building and people have their letters up over their benches. A couple of students sewed them on sweaters that they got and wore them around, but such is their pride that they have to display them every chance they get.
The real reason Anderson started the table hockey tournament was to give departments a chance to mingle. North Bennett Street students are largely on their second or third careers. They're highly motivated and not prone to waste a lot of time socializing. The table hockey tournament has succeeded at getting students to meet each other, but don't assume all that interaction is friendly.
Sometimes they'll shake the players at each other, but they're allowed to trash talk as long as they use terminology from their departments. I mean, it can be violent, but it has to be department specific.
Pound out his slug. Let's go, Paul.
Bring him up.
The trash talking is generally met with giggles. While the earlier matches took place in the hallway, about 30 people have gathered inside the bookbinding department for this fifth-round contest between Paul from violin building and Justin from preservation carpentry. As the game goes into sudden-death overtime, the puck becomes lodged behind Paul's goalie, and the crowd is overcome with excitement.
Oh, that's so weird.
Think about this, Paul.
Oh.
No, 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 no. No. To the left.
With that, Paul Trombley's table hockey season is over. A few minutes later, he can be found at his workbench, patiently filing down a template for the rib structure of his latest violin. He says he's glad he lost. Now he can go back to focusing on his work. But before I can leave the violin department, Seth Gray calls my attention to the NBSS table hockey trophy.
Oh my goodness, it looks like the Stanley Cup!
Seth is a slight guy who doesn't much resemble the plastic-molded hockey players he controls. But despite his peaceful demeanor, he's definitely the most creative of the violin builders when it comes to department-specific trash talk.
Bend your ribs, cut your F-holes, set the neck, trim his button, ream out his peg holes.
String him up.
Yeah, string him up. Gouge out his eyes. That one's a good one.
Wait, do you actually gouge out eyes?
Yeah, the eyes on the scroll. You could use a gouge. You could use a knife, too, so knife out his eyes would be just as gruesome.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light.
3 weeks later, it seems like the entire school has gathered in the piano technology department for the final. The pianos have been pushed into the far corners, and a projection screen is set up to display all the action. As the national anthem concludes, the North Bennett Street School Air Force launches its annual flyover. But most of the paper airplanes don't make it more than a few feet before crashing to the ground. Before he drops the puck, Mark Anderson has one last thought for the participants.
But I have something very sad to say that you guys don't know, and that is, having played in this tournament and won your letter and gotten your jacket, nothing in your life is ever going to equal this again. And I'm so sorry, because, you know, people have had children after this, and their wife says, here's your daughter, and they go, you know, this is nice, but table hockey, you know? But thank you all for playing, and thank you for putting the school on the map. Who wants to be USC when you can be North Bennett Street School?
With that, jewelry maker Joe Balboni is pitted against violin builder Seth Gray. From the start, it's clear that the jewelry makers have a good shot at winning their first championship. After a three-minute half, which is, quite frankly, the longest anyone can be expected to watch two inexperienced players trying to remember which stick controls which little plastic man, Walter McDonald of McDonald Halftime Productions, LLC, steps in to lead the halftime sing-along, a stirring tribute to Mark Anderson, who's leaving the school after 10 years.
Sung this song and I'll sing it again. Mark gave us this game and taught us to grin at hockey and binding now every day. And here's what all of the people here say. It's so long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you.
There's hardly a dry eye in the house as Anderson drops the puck for the second half.
Ready?
Come on, Seth.
Say when.
The second half doesn't go much better for Seth. As the crowd counts down to zero, he frantically shoots the puck with disappointing results.
Six, five, four, three, two, one.
With that, Joe Balboni is presented with the newly renamed Anderson Cup, which he hoists over his head like a true champion. It doesn't take long for the students to dissipate, back to their workbenches and the tasks at hand, many of them relieved that the distraction is over for another year. Though he's losing his athletic director, Miguel Gomez Ibanez isn't worried about the strength of his table hockey program.
We don't believe we have any competition, but if anyone were to contact us and dare to challenge us, we'd be happy to. Well, there's no polite way to say what we'd do to them.
You might set their necks.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gill.
It's so long, it's been good to know ya. So long, it's been good to know ya. So long, it's been good to know ya. Because it's calling to be your new home. And you gotta be moving along. That very first year was tough. Mark couldn't find players. Students were too busy to come down the stairs. He coaxed and cajoled, but never gave up. This year, 64 played for this winning cup. It's so long, it's been good to know you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to peruse our panoply of podcasts, view our many photo galleries, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Pi reciter James Niles Joyle.
014-215-0306-8038.
Well, what did you think he'd say? You go, geek. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
4477-34549-2021. One more time. So long, it's been good to know you. So sorry you're moving along. All right, Mark.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.